Welcome to NEJM This Week. I'm Dr. Michael Bierer. This week, we discuss endovascular therapy for post-thrombotic syndrome, new evidence on pre-hospital blood transfusion strategies in trauma patients, and a trial of cefazolin for Staph aureus bacteremia. We examine evolving approaches to thyroid cancer and share a case of a man with pancytopenia after heart transplantation. Perspectives explore psychedelic therapy, the convergence of Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease, and treating addiction. Endovascular therapy for post-thrombotic syndrome, a randomized trial, by Suresh Vedantham, from Washington University School of Medicine, St. Louis, and co-authors. Post-thrombotic syndrome is common after deep vein thrombosis and can cause severe symptoms involving the limbs that impair patients' activity and quality of life. Endovascular therapy can eliminate chronic venous obstruction and is hypothesized to reduce the severity of post-thrombotic syndrome. In this study, 225 patients with moderate or severe post-thrombotic syndrome and image-confirmed iliac vein obstruction were randomly assigned to receive endovascular therapy, iliac vein stent placement, and enhanced antithrombotic therapy, plus standard post-thrombotic syndrome care or standard post-thrombotic syndrome care alone. At 6 months, the severity of post-thrombotic syndrome assessed with the validated venous clinical severity score tool was lower in the endovascular therapy group than in the no endovascular therapy group. Venous disease specific and overall quality of life were better in the endovascular therapy group than in the no endovascular therapy group. Bleeding was more common in the endovascular therapy group than in the no endovascular therapy group, in 11.6% versus 3.6% of the patients. Ronald Luis Gomez Flumignan and Luis Carlos Uta Nakano from the Universidad Federal de Sao Paulo write in an editorial that pending some further data on follow-up and durability, the trial by Vedantham and co-authors provides the strongest available evidence that endovascular therapy leads to a reduction in the severity of post-thrombotic syndrome and improvement in quality of life in carefully selected patients with moderate or severe disease and confirmed iliac obstruction. Shared decision-making should integrate patient preferences, individual bleeding risk, access to experienced operators, and the realistic magnitude of expected benefit. For patients with severe, refractory post-thrombotic syndrome and a risk of hemorrhage that is deemed to be acceptable, this trial offers a credible basis for incorporating endovascular therapy into individualized care. The trial also establishes that large, rigorous, randomized trials are achievable in this historically difficult-to-study population, a methodologic contribution with implications for the design of future studies. The path forward is clear. Follow these patients, characterize durability, and determine whether today's stent earns its place as tomorrow's standard of care. Pre-hospital whole blood in traumatic hemorrhage, a randomized clinical trial by Jason Smith from the Royal Center for Defense Medicine, Birmingham, United Kingdom, and co-authors. Blood transfusion is a life-saving treatment in the management of severe traumatic hemorrhage. The debate surrounding the relative benefits of transfusing individual blood components, red cells, plasma, or platelets, as compared with whole blood, is ongoing, with a growing emphasis on early pre-hospital transfusion, which is performed as close to the time of injury as possible before arrival at the hospital. In this Phase 3 trial conducted in England, 942 patients with major traumatic hemorrhage who were attended by a participating air ambulance service were randomly assigned to receive either whole blood transfusion up to 2 units or standard care with blood components up to 2 units each of red cells and plasma before arrival at the hospital. Pre-hospital transfusion of up to 2 units of whole blood was not superior to standard care in reducing the risk of death or massive transfusion at 24 hours. No safety concerns were identified with whole blood transfusion. Pre-hospital resuscitation with type O whole blood for trauma and hemorrhage. By Jason Sperry from the University of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and co-authors. Blood transfusion before arrival at a hospital reduces mortality from traumatic hemorrhage and shock. Whether transfusion with whole blood is more beneficial than transfusion with blood components is uncertain, as are the effects of the length of time that blood products are in storage between donation and transfusion. In this Phase 3 cluster randomized trial, 44 AIR medical bases were assigned in a 2-to-1 ratio to the use of up to 2 units of whole blood or as-indicated blood components, plasma, red cells, or both, for pre-hospital transfusion in trauma patients during one-month blocks. 1,020 injured patients were transported to hospitals by the AIR bases. Among these patients, the use of whole blood for pre-hospital transfusion did not result in lower 30-day mortality than the use of blood components. In the observational sub-study, the age of stored whole blood through 21 days from donation was not associated with apparent differences in outcomes. In an editorial, Susan Rowell and Selwyn Rogers, Jr. from University of Chicago Medicine write that the similarity of the outcomes in the two trials by Smith and co-authors and Sperry and co-authors is notable because their designs were so different. They tested different whole blood products against different comparison groups using different randomization strategies, and they measured different primary outcomes in patients enrolled on two continents. However, the investigators in both trials reached the same conclusion, that the administration of 1 or 2 units of cold-stored, leuko-reduced whole blood in the pre-hospital setting produced outcomes indistinguishable from those with component therapy. This consistency suggests that cold-stored whole blood does not produce a measurable survival benefit with the doses tested. Both trials show us that whole blood and component therapy appear to perform similarly at the doses studied, which suggests that blood product selection should be guided by availability, capacity, cost, and operational realities. Neither trial identified a safety concern with either approach, so pre-hospital systems with established blood programs can safely continue to use either whole blood or component therapy. These trials also show us that up to 2 units of whole blood does not outperform component therapy. Whether one is better than the other in specific patient groups remains unknown. Cefazolin for methicillin-susceptible Staphylococcus aureus bacteremia by the Staphylococcus aureus Network Adaptive Platform, SNAP trial group. Staph aureus bacteremia is associated with high mortality, with more than 1 in 4 affected patients dying within 90 days. In this ongoing international trial, cefazolin was compared with an anti-staphylococcal penicillin, flucloxacillin or cloxacillin, in more than 12,000 adult patients with penicillin-resistant, methicillin-susceptible Staph aureus bacteremia. Cefazolin was non-inferior to flucloxacillin or cloxacillin with respect to 90-day mortality and was associated with a lower incidence of acute kidney injury.
Scores of Black veterans aren't getting the medical treatment or compensation they need, all because of their race.
We're doing this lung testing like this, and it's not scientific, and it's hurting patients.
I have seen white veterans get more benefits. And if they're basing it upon color of a skin, that's not right, because we are all veterans.
We are banned from talking about anything that has race in it.
To hear all episodes of The Race Equation from the New England Journal of Medicine, subscribe to Intention to Treat.
Management of Differentiated Thyroid Cancer, a review article by Laszlo Hegedus from Odense University Hospital, Denmark, and co-authors. Modern risk-adapted management of thyroid cancer involves risk stratification as an active, dynamic process that begins with the detection of a thyroid nodule and continues throughout the clinical course of diagnosis, active surveillance or treatment, and follow-up. rooted in clinicopathological staging, which can be further refined with the molecular risk characterization of the tumor, initial management plans are developed and modified over time on the basis of the natural history of the disease and the response to therapy. These authors present a clinical framework for therapeutic decision-making that can be used to compare, contrast, and illustrate the relative risks, benefits, and patient preferences that are integral to the development of a personalized management plan. The authors examine examples of therapeutic decision-making in active surveillance of low-risk papillary thyroid cancer, minimalist therapeutic management options for low and intermediate risk thyroid cancer, and systemic therapies for advanced thyroid cancer, showing how the therapeutic decision-making framework can be used to achieve informed consensus and management recommendations. A 74-year-old man with pancytopenia, a case record of the Massachusetts General Hospital by William Aird and colleagues. A 74-year-old man with a history of transthyretin amyloid cardiomyopathy underwent orthotopic heart transplantation and was treated with standard immunosuppression. Within weeks, he developed worsening anemia requiring multiple red cell transfusions, along with mild thrombocytopenia and leukopenia. He reported persistent fatigue and epistaxis, but had no fever, rash, or other signs of bleeding. Laboratory workup revealed a profoundly low reticulocyte count, rising ferritin, near 100% transferrin saturation, and a markedly elevated erythropoietin level, a pattern pointing to pure red cell aplasia rather than hemolysis or blood loss. Splenomegaly was found on abdominal ultrasound. Bone marrow biopsy showed erythroid maturation arrested at the pro-erythroblast stage, with giant pro-erythroblasts bearing characteristic eosinophilic intranuclear inclusions. Parvovirus B19-specific immunostaining of the biopsy was strongly positive, and serum nucleic acid testing detected more than 100 million DNA copies per milliliter. In this immunocompromised host, parvovirus B19 caused persistent viremia and suppression of red cell production, a well-recognized but easily missed complication of solid organ transplantation. Stemness as the engine of checkpoint durability. A Clinical Implications of Basic Research by Richard Hotchkiss and John DiPersio from Washington University School of Medicine, St. Louis. Checkpoint inhibitors have transformed cancer therapy, with 250,000 to 400,000 patients treated annually in the United States. By blocking programmed cell death protein 1, PD-1, or its ligand, PD-L1, checkpoint inhibitors suppress inhibitory signals that restrain T-cell activation, thereby restoring anti-tumor immunity. Despite early and sometimes dramatic responses, clinical benefits often wane. Retrospective analyses of checkpoint inhibitor re-challenge in patients show lower response rates and diminished durability as compared with initial treatment. These observations lead to the question, can prolonged or intensified PD-1 or PD-L1 blockade paradoxically compromise the long-term immune fitness required for sustained tumor control? A recent study by Hoare and co-authors suggests that it does. Their study provides a mechanistic framework that may reshape how checkpoint inhibitors are deployed and how to extend their durability. Psychedelic therapies in the United States, balancing state and federal oversight. A perspective by Marcus Hughes from Yale School of Medicine, New Haven, Connecticut. With the landscape of psychedelic therapy rapidly evolving in the United States, inconsistent regulatory oversight poses important challenges. Several states have created pathways for supervised use of psilocybin, a psychedelic agent that has been investigated in conjunction with psychotherapy as a treatment for various mental health conditions, whereas federal agencies continue to apply to these products a framework designed for reviewing investigational drugs. These divergent approaches have produced an environment in which patients, clinicians, and policymakers face conflicting expectations about access, safety, and clinical responsibility. As interest in psychedelic therapy grows, the absence of coordinated policies could increase the risk of preventable harm, access barriers, and erosion of public trust, consequences that may disproportionately affect communities that already have uneven access to mental health care. Policymakers face the challenge of creating systems that support safe and equitable care without suppressing innovation and halting momentum. Achieving this balance will require intergovernmental cooperation as well as collaboration with clinical and community stakeholders. A coordinated regulatory approach may offer the best opportunity to ensure that standards for safety, effectiveness, and access reflect shared priorities. Patient-driven care in psychedelic therapy. A perspective by Ya'ara Zisman-Ilani from Temple University, Philadelphia, and Rachel Yehuda from Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York. Despite a decision by the Food and Drug Administration not to approve MDMA-assisted therapy for PTSD, there continues to be broad interest in this therapy, also known as ecstasy. Psychedelic interventions continue to be evaluated in rigorous trials, and regulatory deliberations are expected to resume as additional data accumulate. Amid continuing regulatory discussion, the field of psychedelic medicine faces a choice about how to conceptualize and implement treatments. Rather than treating psychedelics as distinct from psychotherapy or reducing these agents to their pharmacologic effects, the field should frame psychedelic interventions as amplifying the therapeutic processes that underlie effective care. A patient-driven framework for use of MDMA and related compounds, informed by shared decision-making, could preserve patient agency while helping to elucidate the conditions under which psychotherapy is most effective. Psychedelic therapy involves multiple consequential decisions: whether to pursue treatment, how to prepare for treatment, how to navigate sessions, and how to integrate experiences into the broader healing process. Both MDMA and classic psychedelics may heighten openness and suggestibility. Establishing collaborative agreements before sessions regarding goals, pacing, boundaries, and integration plans can preserve autonomy while supporting safety and therapeutic engagement. These considerations are central elements of care that affect both safety and therapeutic outcomes. The convergence of Down syndrome and Alzheimer's disease: scientific and ethical imperatives. A perspective by Michael Raffi from the Massachusetts General Hospital, Boston. Medical advances throughout the late 20th century increased the life expectancy of people with Down syndrome from 25 years to 65 years in the United States. As survival improved, clinicians recognized an unexpected and striking consequence of aging in Down syndrome, a near universal predisposition to Alzheimer's disease. Neuropathologic studies have shown that amyloid plaques and neurofibrillary tangles, which are defining pathologic features of Alzheimer's disease, develop in virtually all adults with Down syndrome. Changes often occur decades earlier than in the general population, with dementia symptoms emerging at an average age of 55 years in people with Down syndrome, and progress more rapidly than in other forms of Alzheimer's dementia. Because APP, the gene encoding amyloid precursor protein, is located on chromosome 21, triplication of this chromosome leads to increased amyloid beta production and accelerated plaque deposition. Research on trisomy 21 has played a critical role in advancing understanding of human genetics, neurodevelopment, and neurodegeneration. Despite many contributions to the understanding of Alzheimer's disease, people with Down syndrome have been essentially excluded from clinical trials for disease-modifying therapies for Alzheimer's. As a result, amyloid-targeting therapies were advanced without evidence to guide their clinical use in this population. Conducting clinical trials in people with Down syndrome will require tailored approaches, but ensuring that people with Down syndrome are meaningfully included in clinical trials in Alzheimer's disease is both a scientific and an ethical imperative. In 1 year, I want you alive. A perspective by James Wilson III from West Brookfield Family Practice, Massachusetts. Dr. Wilson's first opioid-addicted patient came in with back pain. For the first 7 months Dr. Wilson was in practice, he refilled every prescription, every lost bottle, every stolen patch, every small increase. He couldn't believe the amount of pain the patient was in. Then the patient's father called. He had sent his son to a residential program in Vermont for $15,000 a week. When the patient came back, he sat across from Dr. Wilson again and asked for more pills. Dr. Wilson said no. After that, the phone calls started. Parents, the same age as Dr. Wilson, with teenagers and 20-somethings, began calling in tears. The stories were almost identical. Kids buying Percocet off the street, usually the 30-milligram tablets, five a day, $150, just to make it to school or hold a job. By 2012, Dr. Wilson had had enough of watching patients slip away. He became licensed to prescribe buprenorphine naloxone. Dr. Wilson told every new patient the same thing. In 1 year, I want you alive. That focus, keeping people alive, changed everything. The pressure to produce instant recovery disappeared, replaced by something more honest, a goal that felt possible. And it worked. Dr. Wilson and his partner began to notice that most of their patients who received buprenorphine naloxone lived. In a crisis defined by funerals, their survival felt like a miracle. After his first year, Dr. Wilson was allowed to treat 100 patients. For a while, it felt like the tide was turning. The waiting room was calmer. The calls about overdoses slowed. But then the letters started coming. Requests for records, explanations, audits. The same system that once encouraged opiate prescribing now viewed efforts to help people recover, to pull them out of dependency, with suspicion. Dr. Wilson wasn't accused of hurting anyone. He was accused of helping too many people, treating too many people in ways that didn't look neat on paper. Addiction care rarely does. People don't get better in straight lines, and the system wants order that addiction can't give it. In our images in clinical medicine, a 66-year-old man with a history of Crohn's disease treated with long-term adalimumab presented with fever and swelling of both knees. Analysis of a biopsy sample of the left knee synovium showed an atypical T-cell infiltrate, a diagnosis of immunosuppression-associated peripheral T-cell lymphoma, a rare condition associated with exposure to thiopurines and tumor necrosis factor inhibitors, was made. In another image, a 38-year-old pregnant former agricultural worker was referred to the dermatology clinic for evaluation of a long-standing itchy lesion on her abdomen. Histopathological analysis showed thick-walled brown septate spores, a diagnosis of chromoblastomycosis, a chronic progressive implantation mycosis caused by demaciaceous fungi in soil and plant matter, was made. Chromoblastomycosis is typically diagnosed in agricultural workers in tropical or subtropical regions. Read more from our issue at nejm.org. Let us know what you think about our podcast. Any comments or suggestions may be sent to audio@nejm.org. Thank you for listening.